thwart prosecutions in some jurisdictions, it did not slow things in Texas. In fact, Texas is one of several states with a well-developed case law allowing prosecutions in murder cases where there is no definitive proof that a murder has indeed taken place. A dead body is not always required.
No, I did not get that far, he said.
Can you believe it?
I'm not sure what to believe. The phone rang.
Dana snatched it and abruptly informed the caller that the minister was unavailable. When she hung up, she said, Okay, Pastor, what's the plan?
There is no plan.
The next step, the only step I can think of right now, is to have another talk with Travis Boyette. If he admits he knows where the body is or was, then I'll press him to admit the murder.
And if he does, what then?
I have no idea.
Chapter 4. The investigator trailed Joey Gamble for 3 days before he made contact. Gamble wasn't hiding, nor was he hard to find. He was an assistant manager at a mammoth auto parts discount warehouse in the Houston suburb of Mission Bend, his third job in the past 4 years. He had one divorce under his belt and perhaps another on the way. He and his second wife were not living together and had retreated to neutral corners where the lawyers were waiting. There wasn't much to fight over, at least not in assets. There was one child, a little boy with autism, and neither parent truly wanted custody. So they fought anyway. The file on Gamble was as old as the case itself, and the investigator knew it by heart. After high school, the kid played 1 year of football at a junior college, then dropped out. He hung around Sloan for a few years, working at various jobs and spending most of his spare time in the gym, where he ate steroids and built himself into a hulking specimen. He boasted of becoming a professional bodybuilder, but eventually grew tired of the work. He married a local girl, divorced her, moved to Dallas, and then drifted to Houston. According to the high school yearbook, class of 1999, he planned to own a cattle ranch if the NFL thing didn't work out. It did not, nor did the ranch. And Joey was holding a clipboard and frowning at a display of windshield wipers when the investigator made his move. The long aisle was empty. It was almost noon, a Monday, and the store was practically empty.
Are you Joey? The investigator asked with a tight smile just under a thick mustache.
Joey glanced down at the plastic name badge pinned above his shirt pocket.
That's me.
He tried to return the smile. This was, after all, retail, and the customer must be adored. However, this guy did not appear to be a customer.
My name's Fred Pryor.
The right hand shot out like a boxing punch, bound for the gut.
I'm a private investigator.
Joey grabbed it, almost in self-defense, and they shook hands for a few awkward seconds.
Nice to meet you.
A pleasure, Joey said, his radar at full alert. Mr. Pryor was about 50 years old, thick in the chest, with a round, tough face topped with gray hair that required work each morning. He wore a standard navy blazer, tan polyester slacks that were straining at the waist, and, of course, a pair of well-shined pointed-toe boots.
What kind of investigator? Joey asked.
I'm not a cop, Joey. I'm a private investigator duly licensed by the state of Texas.
You got a gun?
Yep.
Pryor flung open his blazer to reveal a 9mm Glock strapped under his left armpit.
You want to see the permit? He asked.
No.
Who you working for?
Dante Drum's defense team.
The shoulders sagged a bit. The eyes rolled. The air escaped in one quick sigh of frustration, as if to say, not that again. But Pryor expected this and moved in quickly.
I'll buy you lunch, Joey. We can't talk here. There's a Mexican place around the corner. Meet me there. Give me 30 minutes, okay? That's all I ask. You get lunch, I get some FaceTime. Then maybe you'll never see me again.
The Monday special was quesadillas, all you can eat for $6.50. The doctor told him to lose some weight, but he craved Mexican food, especially the greased-up, flash-fried American version.
"What do you want?" he asked.
Pryor glanced around as if others were listening.
30 minutes. "Look, Joey, I'm not a cop. I have no authority, no warrant, no right to ask for anything. But you know the history better than me."
Pryor would later report to Robbie Flack that at that point the kid lost his edge, stopped smiling, and his eyes half-closed in a look of submission and sadness. It was as if he knew this day would eventually arrive. At that moment, Pryor was certain they would catch a break. Joey glanced at his watch and said,
"I'll be there in 20 minutes. Order me one of their house margaritas."
"You got it."
Pryor thought that drinking at lunch could be problematic, at least for Joey. But then, the alcohol might help. The house margarita was served in a clear, bowl-shaped pitcher of some sort and was enough of a beverage for several thirsty men. As the minutes passed, condensation formed on the glass and the ice began to melt. Pryor sipped iced tea with lemon and sent a message to Flack. "Meeting J.G. for lunch now. Later." Joey arrived on time and managed to squeeze his sizable frame into the booth. He slid the glass over, took the straw, and inhaled an impressive quantity of the booze. Pryor made some small talk until the waiter took their orders and disappeared. Then he moved in closer and got to the point.
"Dante will be executed Thursday. Did you know that?"
Joey nodded slowly.
"Affirmative. I saw it in the paper. Plus, I talked to my mother last night, and she said the town is buzzing."
The mother was still in Sloan. The father was working in Oklahoma, maybe separated. An older brother was in Sloan. A younger sister had moved to California.
"We're trying to stop the execution, Joey, and we need your help."
"Who's we?"
"I'm working for Robbie Flack."
Joey almost spit. "Is that nut still around?"
"Of course he is. He'll always be around. He's represented Dante from day one, and I'm sure he'll be in Huntsville Thursday night at the bitter end. That is, if we can't stop the execution."
"The paper said the appeals have run out. There's nothing left to do."
"Maybe. But you never quit. A man's life is at stake. How can you quit?"
Another pull on the straw. Pryor hoped the guy was one of those passive drunks who take the booze and sort of melt into the furnishings, as opposed to the hellraisers who knock back 2 drinks and try to clear out the bar. Joey smacked his lips and said,
"I guess you're convinced he's innocent, right?"
"I am. Always have been."
"Based on what?"
"Based on the complete lack of physical evidence. Based on the fact that he had an alibi. He was somewhere else. Based on the fact that his confession is as bogus as a $3 bill. Based on the fact that he's passed at least 4 polygraph tests. Based on the fact that he has always denied any involvement. And Joey, for purposes of this discussion, based on the fact that your testimony at trial was completely unbelievable. You didn't see a green van in the parking lot in the vicinity of Nicole's car. It was impossible. You left the mall through the entrance to the cinema. She was parked on the west side, on the other side of the mall. You fabricated the testimony to help the cops nail their suspect."
There was no eruption, no anger. He took it well, much like a child caught red-handed with a stolen coin and unable to utter words.
"Keep going," Joey said.
"You want to hear it?"
"I'm sure I heard it before."
"Deed you have. You heard it at trial 8 years ago. Mr. Flack explained it to the jury. You were crazy about Nicole, but she wasn't crazy about you. Typical high school drama. You dated off and on, no sex, a rather stormy relationship, and at some point you suspected that she was seeing someone else. Turned out this was Dante Drum, which, of course, in Sloan and in a lot of other small towns, could lead to real problems. No one knew for sure, but the gossip was out of control. Maybe she tried to break it off with him. He denies this. He denies everything. Then she disappeared, and you saw the opportunity to nail the guy.
Nail him you did. You sent him to death row. And now, you're about to be responsible for killing him.
So I'm getting all the blame here?
Yes, sir. Your testimony placed him at the scene of the crime, or at least the jury thought so. It was almost laughable because it was so inconsistent, but the jury was anxious to believe you. You didn't see a green van, you lied. You fabricated. You also called Detective Kerber with the anonymous tip. And the rest is history.
I did not call Kerber.
Of course you did. We had the experts to prove it. You didn't even try to disguise your voice. According to our analysis, you'd been drinking, but weren't drunk. There's a slight slur in a few of your words. You want to see the report?
No, it was never admitted in court.
That's because we didn't know about your phone call until after the trial, and that's because the cops and prosecutors concealed it, which should have led to a reversal, which, of course, is pretty rare here in Texas.
The waitress arrived with a platter of sizzling quesadillas, all for Joey. Pryor took his taco salad and asked for more tea. After a few generous bites, Joey said,
"So who killed her?" "Who knows? There's no proof she's even dead."
"They found her gym card and student ID."
"Yeah, but they didn't find her body. She could be alive for all we know."
"You don't believe that?" A gulp of the margarita to wash things down.
"No, I don't. I'm sure she's dead. Right now, it doesn't matter. We're racing against time here, Joey, and we need your help."
"What am I supposed to do?"
"Recant, recant, recant. Sign an affidavit telling the truth. Tell us what you really saw that night, which was nothing."
"I saw a green van."
"Your friend didn't see a green van, and he walked out of the mall with you. You didn't mention anything to him. In fact, you didn't say anything to anybody for over 2 weeks. Then you heard the rumor that her gym card and student ID had been found in the river. That's when you put together your fiction, Joey. That's when you decided to nail Dante. You were outraged because she would prefer a black guy to you. You called Kerber with the anonymous tip, and all hell broke loose. The cops were desperate and stupid and couldn't wait to pursue your fiction. It worked perfectly. They beat a confession out of him. Only took him 15 hours, and bingo, it's front page news. Dante Drum confesses. Then your memory works a miracle. You suddenly remember that you saw a green van, just like the Drums, moving suspiciously around the mall that night. What was it, Joey, 3 weeks later when you finally told the cops about the van?"
"I saw a green van."
"Was it a Ford, Joey? Or did you just decide it was a Ford because that's what the Drums owned? Did you really see a black guy driving it, or was that just your imagination?" To keep from responding, Joey stuffed half a quesadilla into his mouth and chewed slowly. As he did so, he watched the other diners, unable or unwilling to make eye contact. Pryor took a bite, then pressed on. His 30 minutes would be gone soon enough.
"Look, Joey," he said in a much softer tone, "we can argue the case for hours. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to talk about Dante. You guys were friends. You grew up together. You were teammates for, what, 5 years? You spent hours together on a football field. You won together. You lost together. Hell, you were co-captains your senior year. Think of his family, his mother and brothers and sister. Think of the town, Joey. Think how bad things will get if he's executed. You gotta help us, Joey. Dante didn't kill anybody. He's been railroaded from the beginning."
"Didn't realize I had this much power."
"Oh, it's a long shot. Appeals courts are not too impressed with witnesses who suddenly change their minds years after the trial and hours before the execution. You give us the affidavit, we'll run to court and scream as loud as possible. But the odds are against us. We gotta try, though. At this point, we'll try anything."
Joey stirred his drink with the straw, then took a sip. He rubbed his mouth with a paper napkin and said, "You know, this is not the first time I've had this conversation. Mr. Flatt called me years ago, asked me to stop by his office. This was long after the trial. I think he was working on the appeals. He begged me to change my story, tell his version of the truth. Told him to go to hell."
"I know. I've been working on the case for a long time."
After demolishing half of the quesadillas, Joey suddenly lost interest in lunch. He shoved the platter away and pulled the drink in front of him. He stirred it slowly and watched the liquid spin around the glass.
"Things are a lot different now, Joey," Pryor said softly, pressing. "It's late in the fourth quarter. The game's almost over for Dante."
The thick maroon fountain pen clipped inside Pryor's shirt pocket was in fact a microphone. It was entirely visible, and next to it was a real pen with ink and a ballpoint in case writing was required. A tiny, hidden wire ran from Pryor's shirt pocket to the left front pocket of his slacks, where he kept his cell phone. 200 miles away, Robbie was listening. He was in his office with the door locked, alone, on a speakerphone that also recorded everything. "You ever see him play football?" Joey asked.
"Nope," Pryor answered. Their voices were clear.
"He was something. He roamed the field like Lawrence Taylor. Fast, fearless. He could wreck an offense all by himself. We won 10 games when we were sophomores and juniors, but we could never beat Marshall."
"Why didn't the bigger schools recruit him?" Pryor asked.
"Keep him talking," Robbie said to himself. "Size. He stopped growing in the 10th grade. He could never get his weight above 220. That's not big enough for the Longhorns."
"You should see him now," Pryor said, without missing a beat. "He weighs about 150. Gaunt and skinny. Shaves his head. He's locked up in a tiny cell 23 hours a day. I think he's lost his marbles. He wrote me a couple of letters, did you know that?"
"Nope."
Robbie leaned closer to the speakerphone. He'd never heard this. "Not long after he was sent away, when I was still living in Sloan, he wrote to me. 2, maybe 3 letters. Long ones. He went on about death row and how awful it is. The food, the noise, the heat, the isolation, and so on. He swore he never touched Nikki. Never got involved with her. He swore he was nowhere near the mall when she disappeared. He begged me to tell the truth, to help him win his appeal and get out of prison. I never wrote him back."
"You still had the letters?" Pryor asked.
Joey shook his head. "No, I've moved around so much." The waitress appeared and removed the platter. "Another margarita?" she asked, but Joey waved her off. Pryor leaned forward on his elbows until their faces were 2 feet apart. He began,
"You know, Joey, I've worked on this case for years. Spent thousands of hours not only working but thinking, trying to figure out what happened. Here's my theory. You went nuts over Nikki, and why not? She was cute as hell, popular, hot, kind of girl you want to put in your pocket and take home forever. But she broke your heart, and nothing is more painful for a 17-year-old. You were devastated, crushed. Then she disappeared. The entire town was shocked, but you and those who loved her were especially horrified. Everyone wanted to find her. Everyone wanted to help. How could she simply vanish? Who snatched her? Who could harm Nikki? Maybe you believed Dante was involved, maybe not. But you were a wreck emotionally, and in that state you decided to get involved. You called Detective Kerber with the anonymous tip. And from there, everything snowballed. At that moment, the investigation took a wrong turn and no one could stop it. When you heard the news that he'd confessed, you figured you'd done the right thing. Got the right guy. Then you decided that you wanted a little piece of the action. You concocted the story about the green van, and suddenly you're the star witness. You became the hero to all those wonderful people who loved and adored Nicole Yarber. You took the stand at the trial, raised your right hand, told something that was not the whole truth, but it didn't matter. You were there helping your beloved Nikki. Dante was led away in shackles, taken straight to death row. Maybe you understood that he would one day be executed, maybe you didn't. I suspect that way back then, when you were still a teenager, you could not appreciate the gravity of what's happening now. He confessed. Yes, and his confession is about as reliable as your testimony. For many reasons, people say things that aren't true, don't they, Joey? There was a long gap in the conversation as both men considered what to say next. In Sloan, Robbie waited patiently, though he had never been known for his patience or quiet moments of self-reflection. Joey spoke next. This affidavit, what goes in it? The truth. You state under oath that your testimony at trial was not accurate, so on. Our office will prepare it. We can have it done in less than an hour. Not so fast. So, I would say basically that I lied during the trial. We can dress up the language, but that's the gist of it. We'd also like to settle the matter about the anonymous tip. An affidavit would be filed in court and end up in the newspapers? Sure. The press is following the case. Any last-minute motions and appeals will be reported. So, my mother will read in the newspaper that I'm now saying I lied at trial. I'll be admitting that I'm a liar. That right? Yes, but what's more important here, Joey? Your reputation or Dante's life? But you said it's a long shot, right? So, chances are I'll admit to being a liar and he still gets a needle. Who wins that one? He damn sure doesn't. I don't think so. Look, I gotta get back to work. Come on, Joey. Thanks for lunch. Nice meeting you. And with that, he slid out of the booth and hurried out of the restaurant. Pryor took a deep breath and stared at the table in disbelief. They were talking about the affidavit, then the conversation ended. He slowly pulled out his cell phone and talked to his boss. Did you get all that? Yep. Every word, Robbie said. Anything we can use? No, nothing. Not even close, really. I didn't think so. Sorry, Robbie. I thought at one point he was ready to snap. You did all you could, Fred. Nice job. He's got your card, right? Yes. Call him after work. Say hello. Just remind him you're there and ready to talk. I'll try to meet him for a drink. Something tells me he tends to overindulge. Maybe I can get him drunk and he'll say something. Just make sure it's being recorded. Will do. Chapter 5. On the third floor of St. Francis Hospital, Mrs. Aurelia Lindmar was recovering from gallbladder surgery and doing well. Keith spent 20 minutes with her, ate 2 pieces of cheap, stale chocolate mailed in by a niece, and managed to make a graceful departure when a nurse popped in with a syringe. On the fourth floor, he huddled in the hallway with the soon-to-be widow of Mr. Charles Cooper, a stalwart member of St. Mark's whose bad heart was finally giving out. There were 3 other patients Keith needed to see, but their conditions were stable and they would live until tomorrow, when he would have more time. On the second floor, he tracked down Dr. Herzlich, who was eating a cold sandwich from a machine and reading a dense text as he sat alone in a small cafeteria. "Have you had lunch?" Kyle Herzlich asked politely as he offered a chair to his minister. Keith sat down, looked at the puny sandwich, white bread with a thin slice of some brutally processed meat in the middle, and said, "Thanks, I had a late breakfast." "Fine. Look, Keith, I've managed to snoop a bit, got as far as I can go, actually. You do understand these things." "Of course I do. And I did not intend for you to pry into private matters." "Never. Can't do it. But I've asked around and, well, there are ways of gleaning some of the facts."
Your man has been here at least twice in the past month, lots of tests, and the tumor thing checks out. Not a pretty prognosis. Thanks, Doctor. Keith was not surprised to learn that Travis Boyette was telling the truth, at least about his brain tumor. Can't say any more than that. The doctor managed to eat, read, and talk at the same time. Sure, no problem. What's his crime? You don't want to know, Keith thought. A nasty one. Career boy, long record. Why is he hanging around St. Mark's? We're open to the public, Doctor. We're supposed to serve all God's people, even those with criminal records. I suppose. Anything to worry about? No, he's harmless. Just hide the women and girls, and perhaps the little boys, too. Keith thanked him again and excused himself. See you Sunday, the doctor said, his eyes glued to a medical report. Anchor House was a square, box-like building of red brick and painted windows, the type of structure that could be used for anything, and probably had been since it was hastily constructed 40 years earlier. Whoever built it had been pressed for time and saw no need for involving the architects. At 7 o'clock on Monday evening, Keith entered from the sidewalk off 17th Street and stopped at a makeshift front desk where an ex-con was monitoring things. Yes, sir, he said without a trace of warmth. I need to see Travis Boyette, Keith said. The monitor looked to his left, to a large open room where a dozen or so men were sitting in various stages of relaxation and gazing at a very loud, large television enthralled with Wheel of Fortune. Then he looked to his right, to another large open room where a dozen or so men were either reading battered paperbacks or playing checkers and chess. Boyette was in a wicker rocker, in a corner, partially hidden behind a newspaper. Over there, the man said, nodding. Sign here. Keith signed in and walked to the corner. When Boyette saw him approach, he grabbed his cane and scrambled to his feet. Didn't expect you, he said, obviously surprised. I was in the neighborhood. Got a few minutes to talk? The other men were taking casual note of Keith. The checkers and chess went on without interruption. Sure, Boyette said, glancing around. Let's go to the mess hall. Keith followed him, watching the left leg as it paused slightly with each step, causing the shuffle. The cane jabbed the floor as they clicked along. How awful would it be, Keith asked himself, to live each minute with a grade 4 tumor between your ears growing and growing until your skull seems ready to crack? As miserable a person as he was, Keith couldn't help but feel sorry for him. A dead man. The mess hall was a small room with 4 long folding tables and a wide opening at the far end that gave way to the kitchen. The cleanup crew was making a racket back there, slinging pots and pans and laughing. Rap music came from a radio. It was the perfect cover for a hushed conversation. We can talk here, Boyette said, nodding at a table. Crumbs of food were scattered about. The thick smell of cooking oil hung in the air. They sat down across from each other. Since they had nothing in common but the weather, Keith decided not to waste time. Would you like some coffee? Boyette asked politely. No, thanks. Smart move. Worst coffee in Kansas. Worst in prison. Travis, after you left this morning, I went online, found the website for Dante Drum, and spent the rest of the day lost in that world. It's fascinating and heartbreaking. There are serious doubts about his guilt. Serious? Boyette said with a laugh. There should be serious doubts. The boy had nothing to do with what happened to Nikki. What happened to Nikki? A startled look, like a deer in headlights. Silence. Boyette wrapped his hands around his head and massaged his scalp. His shoulders began to shake. The tick came and went and came back again. Keith watched him and could almost feel the agony. The rap music thumped mindlessly from the kitchen. Keith slowly reached into his coat pocket and removed a folded sheet of paper. He unfolded it and slid it across the table. "Recognize this girl?" he asked. It was a copy of a black-and-white photo printed from the website, a photo of Nicole Yarber, posing in her cheerleader outfit, holding a pom-pom, smiling with all the innocence of a sweet 17-year-old. At first, Boyette did not react. He looked at Nikki as if he'd never seen her before. He stared at her for a long time. Then the tears came without warning. No gasps, no sobs, no apologies. Just a flood of moisture that ran down his cheeks and dripped off his chin. He made no effort to wipe his face. He looked at Keith, and the two men stared at each other as the tears continued. The photo was getting wet. Boyette grunted, cleared his throat, and said, "I really want to die." Keith came back from the kitchen with two cups of black coffee and paper cups, along with some paper towels. Boyette took one, wiped his face and chin, and said, "Thanks." Keith resumed his seat and said, "What happened to Nikki?" Boyette seemed to count to 10 before saying, "I still got her." Keith thought he was prepared for every possible answer, but in fact he was not. Could she be alive? No. He'd spent the past 6 years in prison. How could he keep her locked up somewhere? He's crazy. "Where is she?" Keith asked firmly.
"Buried."
"Where?"
"Missouri."
"Look, Travis, these one-word answers will keep us here forever. You came to my office this morning for one reason, and that was to finally confess. But you couldn't muster the courage, so here I am. Let's hear it."
"Why do you care?"
"That's pretty obvious, isn't it? An innocent man is about to be executed for something you did. Maybe there's time to save him."
"I doubt it."
"Did you kill Nicole Yarber?"
"Is this confidential, Pastor?"
"Do you want it to be?"
"Yes."
"Why? Why not confess, then make a full admission, then try to help Dante Drum? That's what you should do, Travis. Your days are numbered according to what you said this morning."
"Confidential or not?"
Keith took a breath, then made the mistake of taking a sip of coffee. Travis was right. "If you want it to be confidential, Travis, then it is." A smile, a tick. He glanced around, though they had yet to be noticed by anyone else. He began to nod.
"I did it, Pastor. I don't know why. I never know why."
"You grabbed her in the parking lot?" The tumor expanded. The headaches hit like lightning. He grabbed his head again and weathered the storm. His jaws clenched in a determined effort to keep going.
"I grabbed her, took her away. I had a gun. She didn't fight much. We left town. I kept her a few days. We had sex.
You didn't have sex. You raped her."
"Yes. Over and over. Then I did it. And buried her."
"You killed her?"
"Yes."
"How?"
"Strangled her with her belt. It's still there, around her neck."
"And you buried her?"
"Yes."
Boyette looked at the photo. Keith could almost see a smile.
"Where?" "South of Joplin, where I grew up. Lots of hills, valleys, hollows, logging trails, dead-end roads. She'll never be found. They never got close."
A long pause as the sickening reality settled in. Of course, there was a chance he was lying, but Keith could not force himself to believe that. What could he possibly gain by lying, especially at this stage in his miserable life? The kitchen lights went out and the radio was turned off. Three burly black men made their exit and walked through the mess hall. They nodded and spoke politely to Keith, but only glanced at Travis. They closed the door behind themselves. Keith took the copy of the photo and turned it over. He uncapped his pen and wrote something on it. "How about a little background, Travis?" he said.
"Sure. I have nothing else to do." What were you doing in Sloan, Texas?
Working for a company called R.S. McGuire and Sons, out of Fort Smith. Construction. They had a contract to build a warehouse for Monsanto, just west of Sloan. I hired on as a laborer, just a grunt. Crappy work, but it's all I could find. They paid me less than minimum wage, in cash, off the books, same as the Mexicans. 60 hours a week, flat rate, no insurance, no skill, no nothing. Won't be worth your time to check with the company because I's never officially employed. I was renting a room in an old motel west of town, called the Rebel Motor Inn. It's probably still there. Check it out. $40 a week. The job lasted 5 or 6 months. One Friday night I saw the lights. Found the field behind the high school. Bought a ticket and sat with the crowd. Didn't know a soul. They were watching football. Me, I was watching the cheerleaders. Always loved the cheerleaders. Cute little butts, short skirts, dark tights underneath. They bounce and flip and throw each other around, and you see so much of them. They want you to see. That's when I fell in love with Nicole. She was there for me, showing it all. I knew from the first moment that she was the one. The next one. Right. The next one. Every other Friday, I'd go to the games. I never sat in the same place twice. Never wore the same clothes, used different caps. You learn these things when you're tracking someone. She became my whole world. And I could feel the urges getting stronger and stronger. I knew it was about to happen, but I couldn't stop it. I could never stop it, never. He took a sip of coffee and grimaced. Did you see Dante Drum play? Keith asked. Maybe. I don't remember. I never watched the games. Didn't notice anything but Nicole. Then suddenly, no more Nicole. The season was over. I got desperate. She drove this hot little red BMW, the only one in town, so she was not too hard to find, if you knew where to look. She liked the usual hangouts. I saw her car parked at the mall that night. Figured she was at the movies. I waited and waited. I'm very patient when I have to be. When the parking space next to her car became vacant, I backed into it. What were you driving? An old Chevrolet pickup. Stole it in Arkansas. Stole the tags in Texas. I backed it into the parking space so my door was next to hers. When she walked into the trap, I jumped her. I had a gun and a roll of duct tape, and that's all I ever needed. Not a sound. He rattled off the details with an unaffected detachment, as if describing a scene from a movie. This is what happened, this is how I did it, don't expect me to make sense of it. The tears were long gone. It was a bad weekend for Nikki. I almost felt sorry for her. I don't really want those details, Keith said, interrupting. How long did you stay in Sloan after you killed her? A few weeks, I guess. Through Christmas into January. I was reading the local paper, watching the late-night news. Town was in a frenzy over the girl. Saw her mom cry on television. Real sad. Every day there was another search party with a television news crew chasing after it. Fools. Nikki was 200 miles away, sleeping with the angels. He actually chuckled at the memory. Surely you don't think this is funny. Sorry, Pastor. How did you hear about the arrest of Dante Drum? There's a little greasy spoon near the motel, and I like to go there for coffee early in the morning. I heard him talking, said a football player had confessed, a black boy. I bought a newspaper, sat in my truck, read the story, and thought, what a bunch of idiots. I was stunned, couldn't believe it. There was a mugshot of Drum. Nice-looking kid. I remember staring at his face and thinking that he must have had a screw loose. Why else would he confess to my crime? Kind of pissed me off. Boy had to be crazy.
Then the next day his lawyer came out strong in the paper, yelling about how the confession was bogus, how the cops tricked the kid, overwhelmed him, broke him down, wouldn't let him out of the room for 15 hours. That made sense to me. I've never met a cop I could trust. The town almost blew up. The whites wanted to string him up on Main Street. The blacks felt pretty strongly the boy was getting railroaded. Things were tense, lots of fights at the high school. Then I got fired and moved on.
Why were you fired?
Stupid. Stayed too long in a bar one night. The cops busted me for drunk driving, then they realized the truck and tags were stolen. I spent a week in jail.
In Sloan?
Yep. Check it out. January 1999. Charged with grand larceny, drunk driving, and whatever else they could throw at me.
Was Drum in the same jail?
Never saw him, but there was a lot of talk. Rumor was they'd moved him to another county for safety reasons. I couldn't help but laugh. The cops had the real killer. They just didn't know it. Keith made notes, but had trouble believing what he was actually writing. He asked, "How'd you get out?"
"They assigned me a lawyer. He got my bond lowered. I bailed out, skipped town, and never went back. I drifted here and there and then got arrested in Wichita."
"Do you remember the lawyer's name?"
"You still fact-checking, Pastor?"
"Yes."
"You think I'm lying?"
"No, but it doesn't hurt to check the facts."
"No, I don't remember his name. I've had a lot of lawyers in my life. Never paid him a dime."
"The arrest in Wichita was for attempted rape, right?"
"Sort of. Attempted sexual battery plus kidnapping. There was no sex. Didn't make it that far. The girl knew karate. Things didn't go the way I planned. She kicked me in the balls and I puked for 2 days.
I believe your sentence was 10 years. You served 6, now you're here."
"Nice job, Pastor. You done your homework."
"Did you keep up with the Drum case?"
"Oh, I thought about it off and on for a few years. I figured the lawyers and courts would eventually realize they had the wrong boy. I mean, hell, even in Texas they have higher courts to review cases and such. Surely somebody along the way would wake up and see the obvious. Over time, I guess I forgot about it. Had my own problems. When you're in max security, you don't spend a lot of time worrying about other people."
"What about Nikki? You spend time thinking about her?"
Boyette did not respond, and as the seconds limped along, it became obvious that he would not answer the question.
Keith kept scribbling, making notes to himself about what to do next. Nothing was certain.
"Do you have any sympathy for her family?" "I was raped when I was 8 years old. I don't recall a single word of sympathy from anyone. In fact, no one raised a hand to stop it. It went on. You've seen my record, Pastor. I've had several victims. I couldn't stop. Not sure I can stop now. Obviously, sympathy is not something I waste time with."
Keith shook his head with a look of disgust.
"Don't get me wrong, Pastor. I have a lot of regrets. I wish I hadn't done all those terrible things. I've wished a million times that I could be normal. My whole life, I've wanted to stop hurting people. To somehow straighten up, stay out of prison, get a job and all that. I didn't choose to be like this."
Keith deliberately folded the sheet of paper and tucked it into his coat pocket. He screwed the cap onto his pen. He folded his arms across his chest and stared at Boyette. "I guess you're willing to sit by and let things run their course down in Texas."
"No. I'm troubled by it. I'm just not sure what to do."
"What if they found the body? You tell me where she's buried, and I'll try to contact the right people down there."
"You sure you want to get involved?"
"No. But I can't ignore it either."
Boyette bent forward and began pawing at his head again. "It's impossible for anybody else to find her," he said, his voice breaking up. A moment passed and the pain eased.
"I'm not sure I could now. It's been so long.
It's been 9 years. Not that long. I went back to see her a few times after she died. Keith showed him both palms and said, I don't want to hear it. Suppose I call Drum's lawyer and tell him about the body. I won't give your name, but at least someone down there knows the truth. Then what? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. Maybe I can convince someone. I'm willing to try. The only person who can possibly find her is me. And I can't leave the state of Kansas. Hell, I can't leave this county. If I do, they'll bust me for parole violations and send me back to prison. Pastor, I ain't going back to prison. What difference does it make, Travis? You'll be dead in a few months, according to your own words. Boyette became very calm and still, and began tapping his fingertips together. He stared at Keith with hard, dry, unblinking eyes. He spoke softly, but firmly.
Pastor, I can't admit to a murder.
Why not? You have at least 4 felony convictions, all related to sexual assault. You've spent most of your adult life in prison. You have an inoperable brain tumor. You actually committed the murder. Why not have the courage to admit it and save an innocent man's life?
My mother is still alive.
Where does she live?
Joplin, Missouri.
And her name?
You gonna give her a call, Pastor?
No. I won't bother her. What's her name?
Susan Boyette.
And she lived on Trotter Street, right?
How'd you...
Your mother died 3 years ago, Travis.
How'd you...
Google. Took about 10 minutes.
What's Google?
An internet search company. What else are you lying about? How many lies have you told me today, Travis?
If I'm lying, then why are you here?
I don't know. That's an excellent question. You tell a good story and you have a bad record, but you can't prove anything. Boyette shrugged as if he didn't care, but his cheeks turned red and his eyes narrowed.
I don't have to prove anything. I'm not the accused for a change.
Her gym card and student ID were found on a sandbar in the Red River. How does that fit into your story?
Her phone was in her purse. As soon as I got her, the damn thing started ringing and wouldn't stop. Finally, I got mad, grabbed the purse, and threw it off the bridge. I kept the girl, though. I needed her. She reminds me of your wife. Very cute.
Shut up, Travis, Keith said instinctively before he could stop himself. He took a deep breath and patiently said, Let's keep my wife out of this.
Sorry, Pastor.
Boyette removed a thin chain from around his neck.
You want proof, Pastor? Take a look at this.
A gold class ring with a blue stone was attached to the chain. Boyette unsnapped the chain and handed the ring to Keith. It was narrow and small, obviously worn by a female.
That's A-N-Y on one side, Boyette said with a smile. Alicia Nicole Yarber. On other side, you have SHS 1999. Dear old Sloan High.
Keith squeezed the ring between his thumb and his forefinger and stared at it in disbelief.
Show that to her mother and watch her weep, Boyette said. The only other proof I have, Pastor, is Nicole herself. And the more I think about her, the more I'm convinced that we should just leave her alone.
Keith placed the ring on the table and Boyette took it. He suddenly kicked his chair back, grabbed his cane, and stood.
I don't like being called a liar, Pastor. Go home and have fun with your wife.
Liar, rapist, murderer, and you're also a coward, Travis. Why don't you do something good for once in your life? And quick, before it's too late.
Just leave me alone.
Boyette opened the door, then slammed it behind him. Chapter 6
prosecution's theory of guilt had been based in part on the desperate hope that one day someone, somewhere, would find Nicole's body. It couldn't stay submerged forever, could it? The Red River would eventually give it up, and a fisherman or a boat captain or maybe a kid waiting in the backwater would discover it and call for help. After the remains were identified, the puzzle's final piece would fit perfectly. All loose ends would be tied up. No more questions, no more doubts. The police and prosecutors could quietly, smugly, close the book. The conviction without the body was not that difficult to obtain. The prosecution attacked Dante Drum from all angles, and while it pushed relentlessly for a trial, it also banked heavily on the appearance of a corpse. But 9 years had passed and the river had not cooperated. The hopes and prayers, the dreams in some cases, had vanished long ago. And while this caused doubts in the minds of some observers, it did nothing to dampen the convictions of those responsible for Dante's death sentence. After years of rigid tunnel vision, and with so much at stake, they were certain beyond all doubt that they had nailed her killer. They had invested far too much to question their own theories and actions. The district attorney was a man named Paul Coffey, a tough career prosecutor who'd been elected and re-elected without serious opposition for over 20 years. He was an ex-Marine who enjoyed a fight and usually won. His high conviction rate was splashed across his website and, during elections, trumpeted in gaudy advertisements sent by direct mail. Sympathy for the accused was rarely shown. And, like the routines of most small-town district attorneys, the grind of chasing meth addicts and car thieves was broken only by a sensational murder and/or rape. Much to his well-guarded frustration, Coffey had prosecuted only 2 capital murders in his career, a paltry record in Texas. Nicole Yarbers was the first and the most notorious. 3 years later, in 2002, Coffey had won an easier death verdict in a case involving a botched drug deal that left bodies all over a country road. And 2 was all he would get. Because of a scandal, Coffey was leaving office. He'd promised the public that he would not seek re-election in 2 years. His wife of 22 years had left him in a rather swift and noisy exit. The Drum execution would be a final moment of glory. His sidekick was Drew Kerber, who, after his exemplary work in the Drum case, had been promoted to Chief Detective, Sloan PD, a position he still proudly held. Kerber was pushing 46, 10 years younger than the prosecutor. And though they often worked closely together, they ran in different social circles. Kerber was a cop. Coffey was a lawyer. The lines were clear in Sloan, as in most small southern towns. At various times, each had promised Dante Drum that he would be there when he got the needle. Kerber did so first, during the brutal interrogation that produced the confession. Kerber, when he wasn't jabbing the kid in the chest and calling him every name in the book, promised him over and over that he would get the needle and that he, Detective Kerber, would be there to witness it. For Coffey, the conversation had been much briefer. During a break in the trial, while Robbie Flack was not around, Coffey had arranged a quick and secret meeting with Dante Drum under a stairwell just outside the courtroom. He offered a deal. Plead guilty and take life, no parole. Otherwise, you'll get death. Dante declined and again said he was innocent, at which Coffey cursed him and assured him he would watch him die. Moments later, Coffey denied the encounter when Flack verbally assaulted him. The two men had lived with the Yarber case for 9 years, and for various reasons they had often seen the need to go see Reva. It was not always a pleasant visit, not always something they looked forward to. But she was such an important part of the case that she could never be neglected. Reva Pike was Nicole's mother, a stout, boisterous woman who had embraced victimhood with an enthusiasm that often bordered on the ridiculous. Her involvement in the case was long, colorful, and often contentious. Now that the story was entering its final act, many in Sloan wondered what she would do with herself when it was over. Reva had badgered Kerber and the police for 2 weeks as they frantically searched for Nicole, She had wailed for the cameras and publicly berated all elected officials, from her city alderman to the governor, because they had not found her daughter. After the arrest and alleged confession of Dante Drum, she made herself readily available for lengthy interviews in which she showed no patience with the presumption of innocence and demanded the death penalty, and the sooner the better. For many years, she had taught the ladies' Bible class at the First Baptist Church and, armed with scripture, could practically preach on the subject of God's approval of state-sponsored retribution. She repeatedly referred to Dante as that boy, which riled up the blacks in Sloan. She had other names for him, too, with monster and cold-blooded killer being two favorites. During the trial, she sat with her husband Wallace and their two children in the front row directly behind the prosecution, with other relatives and friends wedged closely around them. Two armed deputies were always close by, separating Reva and her clan from the family and supporters of Dante Drum. Tense words were exchanged during recesses. Violence could have erupted at any moment. When the jury announced its death sentence, Reva jumped to her feet and said, "Praise be to God!" The judge called her down immediately and threatened to remove her. As Dante was led away in handcuffs, she could not restrain herself. She screamed, "You murdered my baby! I'll be there when you take your last breath!" On the first anniversary of Nicole's disappearance, and presumably her death, Reva organized an elaborate vigil at Rush Point on the Red River, near the sandbar where the gym card and student ID were found. Someone built a white cross and stuck it in the ground. Flowers and large photos of Nikki were packed around it. Their preacher led a memorial service and thanked God for the just and true verdict that had just been handed down by the jury. Candles were burned, hymns were sung, prayers were offered. The vigil became an annual event on that date, and Reva was always there, often with a news crew in tow. She joined a victims group and was soon attending conferences and giving speeches. She compiled a long list of complaints with the judicial system, the primary one being that of the endless, painful delays, and she became adept at pleasing a crowd with her new theories. She wrote vicious letters to Robbie Flack and even tried writing to Dante Drum. Reva created a website, WeMissYouNikki.com, and loaded it with 1,000 photos of the girl. She blogged incessantly about her daughter and the case, often pecking away throughout the night. Twice, Robbie Flack threatened to sue her for libelous material she published, but he knew it was wiser to leave her alone. She hounded Nikki's friends to post their favorite memories and stories and held grudges against the kids who lost interest. Her behavior was often bizarre. Periodically, she took long drives downriver in search of her daughter. She was often seen standing on bridges, gazing at the water, lost in another world. The Red River bisects Shreveport, Louisiana, 120 miles south and east of Sloan. Reva became fixated on Shreveport. She found a hotel downtown with a view of the river, and this became her refuge. She spent many nights and days there, roaming the city, loitering around shopping malls, cinemas, and any of the other places where teenagers like to gather. She knew it was irrational. She knew it was inconceivable that Nikki could have survived and was alive and hiding from her. Nonetheless, she kept driving to Shreveport and watching the faces. She couldn't quit. She had to do something. Several times Reva dashed off to other states where teenage girls went missing. She was the expert with wisdom to share. "You can survive this," was her motto. Her effort to soothe and comfort the families, though many back home wondered how well she was surviving. Now, as the final countdown was underway, she was in a frenzy with the details of the execution. The reporters were back, and she had plenty to say. After 9 long and bitter years, justice was finally at hand. Early Monday evening, Paul Coffey and Drew Kerber decided it was time to go see Reva. She met them at the front door with a smile, even quick hugs. They never knew which Reva they would find. She could be charming, and she could be frightening. But with Dante's death so close, She was gracious and vibrant. They walked through the comfortable suburban split level to a large room behind the garage, an add-on that had become Reva's war room over the years. Half was an office with filing cabinets, the other half a shrine to her daughter. There were large framed color blow-ups, portraits done posthumously by admirers, trophies, ribbons, plaques, and an award from the 8th grade science fair. Most of Nikki's life could be traced through the displays. Wallace, her second husband and Nicole's stepfather, was not at home. He had been seen less and less over the years, and it was rumored that he simply couldn't take much more of his wife's constant mourning and griping. She served them iced tea as they sat around a coffee table. After a few pleasantries, the conversation moved to the execution.
"You have 5 slots in the witness room," Coffee said. "Who gets them?"
"Wallace and I, of course. Chad and Marie are undecided, but will probably be there."
She threw out the names of Nicole's half-brother and half-sister as if they couldn't decide to go to the game or not. "The last place will probably be Brother Ronnie. He doesn't want to watch an execution, but he feels the need to be there for us." Brother Ronnie was the current pastor of the First Baptist Church. He'd been in Sloan for about 3 years, had obviously never met Nicole, but was convinced of Drum's guilt and afraid to cross Reva. They talked for a few minutes about the protocol on death row, the rules regarding witnesses, the timeline, and so on.
"Reva, could we talk about tomorrow?" Coffee asked.
"Of course we can."
"Are you still doing the Fordyce thing?"
"Yes. He's in town now, and we'll film at 10 in the morning, right here." "Why do you ask?"
"I'm not sure it's such a good idea," Coffee said, and Kerber nodded his agreement.
"Oh, really? And why not?"
"He's such an inflammatory character, Reva. We are very concerned about the aftershocks Thursday night. You know how upset the blacks are." "We are expecting trouble, Reva," Kerber added.
"If the blacks start trouble, then arrest them," she said.
"It's exactly the kind of situation Fordyce loves to pounce on. He's an agitator, Reva. He wants to start trouble so he can get in the middle of it. Helps his ratings."
"It's all about ratings," Kerber added.